ladies and gentlemen out there in radio listener land. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports, RSG, Renegade Radio. We're going to hold you down for the next 2 hours, 8:30 to 10:30 Central Time, like we always do. I got my man, Phil T, Sports PhD, holding me down. Just got the three-man weave. You know, he's one of those cats, always brings it. You can never stop him. You can only hope to contain him. My man.
Hey, man. Honolulu Blue. All I got to say, like you said last week, I like to be right.
Hey, and we're going to get into that, and we're going to get into a lot more. We're going to talk some NFL. We're going to talk about the Honolulu Blue. We're going to talk about the Buffalo Bills. They ain't been good since I was in, like, ninth grade. So, you know, we're going to have to touch on, I mean, both teams, honestly. To be honest with you, both teams have been good since I was in about ninth grade, which was about 94, 95. So we're going to get into that, and we're going to get into a lot more. D. Wills, you know, he fell ill tonight. He's on the IR. He may pop in at some point tonight, but we're going to all wish him well, wish him a speedy recovery. He didn't want to take that shot. You know, he didn't want to get Romo'd up to get on the show.
He's looking at the big picture. He's looking at the big picture, especially
yeah,
baseball. You know, baseball coming in. You know, D. Wills going to make sure he's in good shape.
Yeah, he got a career to think about.
Right.
In the words of the Trust Rule, I got kids to feed. So we'll get into it like we always do at this time. We're going to get in with the funky editorial.
Fellas, one thing we need to say. Shall we say it, y'all? Melvin,
right.
Jimmy, Coleman, Ryan, say it.
Yeah.
Everybody want to get funky one more time.
All right, so tonight, we got a great show lined up for you. With the funky editorial, we're going to hit on the NBA. We're going to give you a quick update on the whole NBA labor situation. You know, this is the time of year where training camps start to open up, and for basketball junkies, that's a big deal. And I consider myself a basketball junkie. I got tracks all up my arm, you know, and that's just how I be. I'm like West Indian Archie. If you ever seen the Malcolm X movie, you know, when he came back, that's me when it comes to basketball. I'm laid up, house is a mess, but I got NBA TV on. And I'm sitting there in my chair, eyes half open, watching, you know, the Bobcats practice. You know what I'm saying? So that's how I get down, though. So we want to give you all a quick update on
ugly picture, man. It's a real ugly picture right there.
That's a real ugly picture. You know, I had to paint a little picture for the people out there. Just give them an idea to have an accurate representation of how I get down. But that's how the game changer does it. So we're going to give you guys, you ladies and gentlemen who listen to us, a quick update on the state of the NBA labor talks. We're going to dig into them, give you our perspective, that unique perspective that you can only get from the Real Sports Guys, the Renegades, the Internet Radio, you know, the Internet Radio Corner Boys, as we like to call ourselves. We're going to give you all that. So we're going to get into it real quick. So we're going to give you a quick and dirty rundown of where they're at in the conversations. They've been at this since June 30, going back and forth, periodic meetings. Two meetings in July. Now the meetings have picked up, where they're meeting weekly. Both sides, the owners and the players. Why a lockout? A lot of the owners are claiming broke. I think the estimated number is only 9 teams were in the black last year, which means they made money. Everybody else floundering, swimming in the red. That's the owner side of the story. The player side of the story is that it's actually the other way around. Only about 9 teams were in the red, and the other 21 teams are doing just fine. So that's the player side. So what the rub in the situation is that the owners want shorter contracts. They want a rollback salary. They want a hard salary cap. And they want to increase the age limit. So those are the main issues. Of course, the players want to keep the same system in place with the soft cap. They may be willing to give on the age limit. You know, they don't want to see salaries roll back. They don't want to see any money, and they want to encourage revenue sharing amongst the owners. which is something that, you know, they're trying to figure out. So the talks at this point have been pretty much stalled. There hasn't been very much progress. And part of that is because the owners won't move off of the hard cap system that they like to put in place. They want a system where there is a ceiling on salary that is what you would call a hard cap, where you can't exceed that at all. No team can exceed that. Right now, they have what is called a soft cap, where you can exceed the salary cap, and then after a certain point, you go into a luxury tax where you have to match dollar for dollar whatever you're over. So if you're $9 million over the luxury tax, then you have to also kick in another $9 million on top of that. So you can have a great team. You can pay for a great team if you want, but you got to kick in a little bit more on the backside or the back end of it. Right now, I think the split between the players and the owners is about 56 to 44 in favor of the players. So the players are getting about 56% of all revenues and monies brought in. The owners are getting about 44. They want that number to change. They want that number to come a little bit closer to 50-50. The players don't want that. They worked really hard to get the current system in place, and they want to keep it there. What's become more interesting about this situation as it's come forward right now is that the disagreement that is holding up progress in these labor discussions is not with the players. It's not between the players and the owners. It's between owners and owners, which is making the situation very interesting. Because now we have owners fighting with owners. And we've discussed this before on this show. You have owners like Jerry Buss, who bought his team in, you know, the 80s, mid-80s sometime, for a much cheaper price than, say, Dan Gilbert, who purchased the Cavs somewhere between $300 and $200 million. And when you invested $200, $300 million in something, you feel pretty damn motivated to get a return on that investment. Whereas Jerry Buss is living off house money right now. Whatever he's getting, he's made back. His team is worth more than he bought it for. And I think that's what you're seeing is you're seeing owners who bought in early. They're good because their investment is paid off and they are, you know, reaping the benefits of owning a team that's worth way more than they purchased it for. Whereas you have these new owners who are coming in, and they're hemorrhaging money right now because their teams are not nearly worth the investment that they've put into them within the last 5-6 years. And so it seems as if, you know, and also I think you have a small market, big market element going on right now where you have small market teams like Cleveland and, you know, Milwaukee, and those owners are thinking, look, we need a hard salary cap because we can't afford to exceed the luxury cap year in and year out to compete, and we want a competitive system. So you have several elements at play. And of those elements, you know, right now they've called off the preseason games, which nobody really gives a damn about. Let's just be real about that. I've never watched the NBA preseason. And again, this is the West Indian Archie of basketball talking, of NBA basketball talking to you right now. And I ain't never watched a preseason game. I just don't care that much. I love basketball, and I'm a junkie. But preseason games, I'm good. I actually would rather watch a summer league game than a preseason game. I don't know why that is. I think it's because in the preseason you expect to see stars. And you can actually see him sitting on the bench. I think this kind of aggravates me a little bit. It's like seeing candy behind a glass window for a kid, and it's like, it's right there. It's right there. But I can't reach it. There's glass in between. That's what it's like watching a preseason game, I think, for me, if I needed to explain that. I think that's how I would wrap that up in a nutshell for you all to help you understand how that works in my head.
It's kind of like getting a whooping by your mom and dad when you're 7. Then you're forced to look out the window and see all your other friends have a merry time out in the street.
can happen to me.
Yeah, it happened to everybody at least once. I think if you grew up with some country parents, it happened at least once.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, didn't you hate that?
Oh, I mean, it was the worst type of punishment. It was. It was the worst type of punishment. But,
Then you had that one friend. Then you had that one friend, your one boy who knew you was on punishment because he knocked on the door. You know, your friends come. Can your kids come outside?
Yeah.
Miss Flowers, can your kids come outside? Mr. Thompson, can your kids come outside? And so you had that one boy, who your friend who came to get you. You know, said, hey man, come on man, we finna get a football game going. And just come on outside. And yeah, man, I'm in trouble. I got a whooping early. I can't even do that.
You say it with a very low voice, a very low and embarrassed voice. Yes.
And he like, oh, you got a whooping? All loud and put you on blast. He's like, man, you don't shut up, man. And your boy put you out there. And he the one in the window. He see you in the window. He look at your wave.
Right.
Hey,
he's showing off now. He's
show you the
out.
Football. Put the football out. Hey, you see this? Yeah. You take off down the street. Next time you see him, you slap him in the back of the head. You know, spit in his candy or something. You know what I'm saying? You get him back. You get him back. You know, throw the football at his nuts. Do something crazy like that.
Wow. Yeah, we both had some moments. Yeah.
Yeah. You get the guy back. You get the guy back. But yeah, we had that moment. We've all had that moment. So, right now, you know, this is where the NBA's at. And the fact that it's the owners who are kind of infighting, I love that. Because the players, if they stand strong, they can really make some headway as far as progressing. Now, I'm gonna throw it to Phil T right now and get his perspective on the whole situation. The thing I want you to touch on, Phil T, is what is your perception of where we're going as far as the possibilities of actually having a full 82 game season at this point?
I think it's very unlikely. Chris Broussard from ESPN actually is much more optimistic than myself. He seems to think there might be. Well, they're obviously going to miss some preseason games, but he's still optimistic that they can get this thing going and not miss any regular season games. I just don't see it there because, and maybe it's the media coverage of it now compared to football. With football, this was such a big deal coming up to the time where training camp was delayed in the first 2 weeks that we didn't have training camp. There was just so much more of a state of urgency. You don't see that in basketball. And also, I don't think you see the fan base caring as much because they kind of have football, where football fans, you know, come into August, around August or so. I mean, we were really hungry to see this thing happen. And I don't think people are going to truly miss basketball until about a week after the Super Bowl, quite honestly. And maybe not even still then because people really start paying attention to basketball come March, come April, when these playoff races start to heat up. You know, just like we're going to talk about baseball a little bit later with RJ when he comes on. I mean, this is when people really start digging in. And so basketball, hopefully this is a sign. Hopefully, you know, they're meeting, they're having meetings, they're getting together. I think that's a good sign. They're talking, both sides are talking. But hopefully this is a slap in the face to say, hey, we can't do what football did and get away with it. We can't. You know, like D always says, football kind of got the golden goose. You know, people are interested in football from the first game of the season through the last tick in the Super Bowl. Basketball doesn't have that luxury. And honestly, I think they need to leverage this time where the spotlight isn't on them, where they can kind of get things going. Because guess what? Some of these guys can go overseas. They're going to get used to that tax-free money. And, again, it's going to get the players even more leverage in the future. In terms of they're not happy with their deals, you're going to see guys do what Carson Palmer did. I'm not happy, I'm going elsewhere. I'm getting paid elsewhere, you know, like Josh Childress did a couple of years ago. The last thing is I have a lot of confidence in David Stern. I think what he's, what the game has done on his clock since the 80s to the point where it's at now says a lot about his leadership. And I like Billy Hunter, too, on the player side. I just got confidence that they can get this thing done and it'll be less of an issue than it was 13 years ago. And we had this in 98-99 where they missed 30-something games and played a 50-game season.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. I think I'm not nearly as optimistic as Chris Broussard. I'm looking at his article right now. I'm not nearly as optimistic as he may be about the possibilities. But I agree with you. I think basketball has always been kind of the little brother of the major sports. If baseball has a great season, mainstream media is quick to kick basketball to the curb. And ultimately, in my opinion, it's because Young, Rich, and Black don't sell. It just don't. You know, the players are too visible. The players have too much individual players have too much an impact on the outcome of the games. And I think the nature of that bugs people a little bit. Because ultimately, you know that if you ain't got LeBron or if you ain't got Kobe or, you know, if it's Dirk or D-Wade or whoever it may be, D-Rose, you have a considerable less chance of winning in a basketball game where you can go to war against Peyton Manning, you can go to war against Tom Brady, as was proven this weekend, and still come out with a victory with Ryan Fitzpatrick as your quarterback. You know, that can happen in football. In baseball, you can have a team like San Francisco Giants win the World Series last year, you know, with a hell of a pitching staff, but not really a whole bunch of hitting. You know, they really didn't have any sluggers. You know, it wasn't a real balanced team, but they had enough pitching to pull out a World Series victory. So, but in the NBA, it's a little bit different. If you don't have that one key star, if you don't have that one guy who can dominate 8 to 9 minutes of a game and really take it over and control it and have a major impact, you really are hard-pressed to be able to win. You know, if you think about recent memory, the Detroit Pistons in 2004, probably the only NBA team who defied that particular, I wouldn't necessarily call it a rule, that particular observation. I call it an observation, something I've observed. But even then, that was a team that had, you know, they didn't have one guy. Even though they did not have one guy, they had a cast of guys who, instead of giving you 9 minutes of dominant basketball, they can give you four or five. And they had about five or six guys who could do that, who could give you 4 or 5 minutes of dominant basketball, and they played well together as a unit. And I think that rubs people the wrong way. And also, 82 games. Like you said, with baseball, it's 162 games. I have no reason to care about game 84 in a baseball season. In the same way, I don't blame somebody who is not into basketball if they really don't care about game 56, you know, or that's happening on a Tuesday night in, you know, Milwaukee or Indianapolis. What's the rub? Whereas in the NFL, 16 games, 16 weeks, you know, as Tony Romo said, you know, as an NFL quarterback, it really only matters if he shows up for 16 days, you know, and that's what he gets paid to do, show up for 16 days. And that's how fans feel about it. I got 16 days to cheer for my team before I have to wait months and months and months to do this again. And it's more on people's minds. And NBA, that's just the reality of the way we view sports. But I think, I hope that they understand that. I think they understand that. And, again, I have a lot of faith in David Stern. You know, I don't think he gets enough credit for being – I think he's the best commissioner of any league today. And I would even put him above Tagliabue, because when Tagliabue was a commissioner, I definitely put him above Goodell because, you know, I don't like him. but I think, you know, he he's done a great job of riding the waves of the cultural changes of the game and getting the game back to a place where it has a stable of young superstars who are, you know, marketable, who are they can do well on Wall Street, they can do well on Main Street, and they can do well on MLK Boulevard, if you get my drift. And so he has a stable of athletes who can balance that cultural shift and still be marketable among several different demographics. And, you know, he's navigated the league through that. And I think he understands what he's up against. He understands where the league stands. If anybody knows about the league's image problem, it's David Stern, because he's done a bunch of dumb stuff, in my opinion, to try and deal with it. I understand why he does those things. I don't agree with him, but I understand. Whereas with Goodell, some of the stuff he do, I just don't understand. I definitely don't agree with it.
Basketball has stolen, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but basketball has stolen a lot of athletes in other sports. You know, basketball has also transcended race lines as well. You know, you look at it 30, 40 years ago, you didn't see as many white basketball players in the league where you see now. A lot of those guys were playing baseball. A lot of those guys were doing different stuff. Where, you know, you go into an NBA arena right now, you'll hear Ludacris playing during timeouts. You'll hear Aerosmith playing. But the NBA has just done a good job in terms of incorporating hip-hop, incorporating, you know, just a bunch of different demographics involved into their sport. And they've got that momentum going. I just don't want to see them lose that, especially when they're losing their products in terms of players playing elsewhere. I mean, think about if the NBA got to a model where players, almost like what professional women basketball players do. You know, most of them play a couple of seasons. They play in the WNBA, but they also play overseas. Now, that's partially due because it's, you know, they don't have the financial stability that NBA players have, and it kind of makes sense for them to play year-round or close to it. But again, I mean, the NBA has a lot of good things going. Don't mess around with that.
I second that motion. They do. And they're in a great place right now. Like I said, they're in a great place. You have guys who are household names, from LeBron to Dwayne Wade to Derrick Rose to Kobe Bryant, Dirk Nowitzki, Tim Duncan. All of these players are household names, and people know who they are. People, you know, are familiar with the brands. They're familiar with the teams. It's in a very good place. Now, one thing I want to talk about is that piece of guys, because we've had some guys who have gone overseas, and with a lot of these deals that guys are signing, they can opt out,
right,
and come back. Now, there are four players of note who have taken deals in China. Now, what Chinese teams have done is because they own us, and they can do what they want. Chinese teams have said that if NBA players sign a contract with a Chinese team in the Chinese league, they cannot opt out until the year is over. So they can't come back during the season. Now, three players of note, Kenyon Martin, Wilson Chandler, and J.R. Smith, all three of the Denver Nuggets. The fourth player is Earl Clark. The fourth player is Earl Clark. He's not of note, though. I just give him a little footnote. All three Denver Nuggets. Team Stupid is what I like to call them. They've all signed these deals, and they ain't coming back. All of them got neck tats. I don't know if there's a correlation, if that's just a coincidence. Speculate with me for a moment, my friends. Why in the hell would you do that?
I have no solid reason. Back to you. Back to you.
And I'm with you on that, man. I don't understand it.
I tell you what, though. I'm not sure what these three guys are doing. But, again, it goes back to the NBA allowing Pandora's box to be open. Okay? Because, again, the Nuggets, if if these three players can't get out of their deals, the Nuggets are kind of screwed because these players, unless they get some kind of exception or exemption, are still going to count against their caps. You know, so they're going to be somewhat handcuffed in terms of what moves they can make. The other thing is, you know, what if LeBron James or Dwight Howard decided to go over to China every year and play 20, 30 games? You know, these are players, and a lot of stars nowadays, they're looking at their brand, a global brand. You know, we've talked about LeBron saying publicly many times that he wants to be the first athlete who's a billionaire. And just logistically thinking about that, that's real possible if you get a piece of that Chinese market. If you get a piece of the global market, you're not just focusing on what Nikes or McDonald's can do for you in the States. And so a lot of these guys, they go on tours in the summer to try to get that exposure. But what if they had more of an association to a team where that team can market them being, you know, on their schedule and part of their team for 20, 30 games a year? You know, and that takes away from what, you know, the NBA having the exclusive rights on these guys. So again, I think the NBA is just, you know, the players have made a concession. You know, like you said, they were at 57% in terms of the revenue sharing. The last player's proposal wants them, you know, has them at 52, 53%. The owners want them to be in the 40s, in the 40s somewhere. You know, I mean, so this is a big gap. This is a big, big gap. But again, I'm encouraged that they're still talking.
Yeah, man. As we're talking right now, I'm doing research and looking at articles and things as we're discussing this. And there's an article by Malcolm Gladwell, author of books such as Blink and what's the other one, Outliers. And he's got an article about the Nets and NBA economics. And the reason I'm even mentioning this is because we got a picture of the cats in Brooklyn breaking the ground on Atlantic Yards, and they all got their shovels. And Jay-Z is sitting here. And this fool got the nerve to have his hard head cocked. This man is in a tailored suit. He got the nerve to have his hard hat with a little tilt to it. I ain't mad at him, though. I just had to share that with the listeners out there, man. It's funny. It's a good article. Good read. Fairly quick read. Check it out if you get an opportunity. But the picture kind of cracked me up, you know, JB and J at all. But I agree with you, man. This situation, the game is global, and I think, we've said it, you know, you, Devon, and I have said it all along that this is, for the owners, it's not going to go the way things went down for the NFL. The players have the leverage. The game is global. Players can go places, other places, and play basketball. I mean, they can even play basketball here in other venues and other settings. You know, people argue all the time, and this is an interesting debate, and it always tells me where a person's comfort level with other races lies. And I'll explain that, because people always want to say, well, baseball has the best All-Star weekend. We all know it's not football, because football just doesn't translate well in an All-Star-like setting where you get a group of guys together, and it's just not the same. You know, football is too scripted. It's too rehearsed. It's like class. Football is kind of like classical music. It's real hard to be spontaneous. It's possible, but the structure of classical music usually doesn't allow you to be very spontaneous. But basketball is like jazz, where you get five cats together, and if they know how to play, you're gonna see a nice game. No matter who they are, no matter if they know how to play ball, you're going to see a nice game. It's like putting a great jazz band together. If you got a bunch of master musicians, you throw them up there to play some jazz, you're going to get some tight jazz. If they've ever played together or not, if they know what they're doing, they can work it out. I say basketball has the best all-star format because of that reason, but also because of that reason, you have these touring, you know, like – the big three in Miami are going to have a charity game. You know, you've had guys traveling to different summer leagues and pro-ams playing all summer, playing basketball, you know, just playing. and creating a name for themselves. You know, I think Kevin Durant increased his legend tenfold this summer. You talk about being able to market yourself on MLK Boulevard. Durant has gone a long ways to be able to make a name for himself, have his name ring out on any MLK in any major city in the U.S. Just by what the work he's put in over the summer, you know, when you hear kind of stories of legend, like you would hear about Connie Hawkins and you would hear about Daryl Dawkins and Dr. J and Kareem back when he was younger, and you hear about these cats going to the Rucker or playing in the Drew League and dropping 50, 60, 70 points on cats. And you hear old cats in the barbershop talking about being there. Kevin Durant has had multiple moments like that this summer where he's gone places and just showed his ass. He's gone places and just shut it down. And that legend has been created. That legend has been built. And now, you know, he's increased his street cred, his rep. His rep in the hood is solid now. There's no. He may play in Oklahoma City, but he's going to get love in D.C. He's going to get love in L.A. He's going to get love in the Bronx, in Brooklyn. He's going to get love in the Chi. That's just how it's going to go for him now because he's established himself as a cat who can play anywhere. You roll a ball out and he'll bust anybody. And so because of that, you know, the players have all the leverage. The players can continue to brand themselves without the league being even in season. If the players wanted to, and they've done this, they have the Las Vegas League that they're running right now, League in Vegas. If they wanted to, they could get together and form their own league and people would watch. And for me, if I was an NBA owner, that would be a scary thought. That these guys could get together, if you took the top 50 NBA players, if you took the top 50, 60, maybe top 120 NBA players, 120 guys, the top 120 NBA players, divided them up into 10, 12-man teams and had them play in the league, fans, the ownership, structures, people would go and watch that. You could fill arenas with that. And you probably have a better brand of ball than you have with the 30 teams you got in the league right now. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. You know, a shoe is going to have to drop eventually. We'll see who folds and who gives in, but I think the leverage lies with the players right now. You got owners infighting. If the players can stand strong, the one element that may affect the players is the agents. Because while the players are doing fine, some of these agents ain't getting they've already been paid. And they don't get, you know, any money unless new deals get made, unless new contracts get signed. They don't really get any more. They're not really getting any more checks. And so their cash flow has dried up a little bit. So I think some of these agents are pushing some of these guys to get. And I think that's what happened with the cats from Denver. Either their money wasn't right or, you know, maybe they see an opportunity that I don't really see being stuck in China. I don't mind. I think playing in China is great. Like you were talking about Dwight Howard, guys like that going over there and playing 30 games. You know, 20 to 30 games over there and then coming back. I think that's perfect. But to be stuck over there for a whole year, I won't say stuck, but to be there for a whole year, I think ultimately hurts them and it hurts that team more than anything. Even though all of those guys are free agents also. So, again, I think their agents were like, look, sign a deal. I need to get paid because you ain't got no money coming in this year anyway. So, you know, get signed, get some money. At least you got some guaranteed bread. So I think that's the one piece that could erode the players' unity right now. But the players are standing strong. I'm always standing with the players in these situations because their ability to generate income at this level is finite. These owners can do what they do forever. But the players, their ability to generate this type of income for themselves and their families is very much a fleeting thing. So, you know. So we're gonna transition real quick to our next segment. You wanna throw anything else out there in regards to the funky editorial on the NBA situation, bro?
No, sir. I'm ready for five.
All right, we got you. Five
on the black hand side.
So
So we got a nice jam-packed five on the black-hand side for you. And with five on the black-hand side, we take five. We take a topic and we break it down into five pieces, and we get at each of those five pieces and we give our opinion on it. So what we're going to get into today, it's with the Romo hype. You know, Romo was in the tanks after week one. Now everybody's loving Romo. With the media kind of trying to take a chunk out of Mike Vick right now, which they always do, I think it's much ado about nothing. Peyton Manning on the shelf. We're going to look at the NFL QB position and give our rankings. And we're going to get into why we rank guys, where we rank them, why we left guys off, all that good stuff. We're going to get into it. In only a fashion and in only a way that your internet corner boys, the RSG crew, Renegade Radio can. All right, so the first one, number one in the five on the black-hand side is give me your top five QBs. And we're going to do this our way, and we're going to say in order. A lot of these so-called experts be chumping out, and you just want to throw five names out there. We're going to give them to you in order. So, Brother D. Newell.
You know, I mean, ranking quarterbacks to me is one of the toughest things because it's such a subjective type of thing. You know, where in baseball, okay, let's go on to take the batting average. Let's look at the power numbers. Let's look at some other statistics. And it's more of an apples-to-apples comparison because most of these hitters are, you know, in large facing the same pitchers over the course of a season. You know, you look at basketball, similar type of argument. Football, there's just so much more involved with it in terms of, you know, the offensive line, the system you have, the quality of your defense. You know, are you typically behind? Are you typically ahead? That can skew your numbers. So with that being said, here's my five. So at number five, I got Drew Brees. At number four, I've got Rodgers out of Green Bay. At number three, I got Michael Vick. And I'll stop there. I know when I was putting this together, a few people I talked to were really surprised that I had Vick this high at number three. And quite honestly, I think when you consider the aspect and the dynamics that he can bring to the game in terms of a game planning perspective and the development that he's had, I'm willing to put him this high, which kind of goes against my cardinal rule. I don't like to put guys this high in terms of quarterbacks unless they've done it over a sustained amount of time, at least a couple of seasons. But the way Vic played last year, and even so far this year, you know, if you take out his injuries and the time he's missed, he just opens up the field so much. I think because of Mike Vick and because of everything he brings to the table, this makes McCoy so much better. It makes all his receivers and his other weapons so much more dangerous because the defense, essentially, they have to assign a guy or two to Michael Vick on every passing situation. And that means you can't double up DeSean Jackson, even though he has all that speed. That means, you have to keep Macklin underneath and kind of give him the underneath routes. That also limits the guys that you can either commit to be in or out of the box. You got some guys that are just kind of, you know, shadowing him, and they're kind of like in no man's land. Next, I got Peyton Manning. I think we have a tendency to forget guys when they're hurt. But think about Peyton Manning. He's really never had a strong defense. He's had some adequate ones, but really not a dominant defense ever. He's never really had a dominant running game, things that I think help quarterbacks. He's still, you know, been an elite quarterback for the better part of a decade. And then number one is Tom Brady. You know, enough said with that one.
Okay.
What's your top five?
My top five. At five, I have Ben Roethlisberger as my number five. At four, I have Aaron Rodgers. At three, Drew Brees. At two, I have Tom Brady. And at one, I have Peyton Manning. Now, I'll get into mine real quick and why I have – the two I'll touch on is why I have Manning one. I think right now the consensus is that
Brady is the top guy. I'll get into why I have Manning one, and why Roethlisberger is in my top five as opposed to a Michael Vick or Philip Rivers. So, for me, Roethlisberger, I think, you know, I hear your points about Vick. Where I'm at with Vick is that if you get a solid game plan on him, you know, you can beat his team. He makes a lot of plays, and then it's helped. You know, he makes a lot of plays. He's exciting to watch. And I have him, if I were to go further, I'd probably have him at six. And part of it is because that longevity, that he's had one really amazing season. And he's had some decent seasons. But with me and Vic, anytime that there seems to be expectations, he seems to struggle. Last year there was no expectations. For the first time in his career, he was playing without expectation. And he balled. This year he's struggling to start out, whether it's the contract, whether his teams have a little bit more film on them, so they have a better game plan. Whatever it may be, he seems to be struggling a little bit. Whereas with Roethlisberger, he's kind of grown. He's grown over time. He came in, he was a guy that the Steelers would give half the field, say, make a read on this half of the field, and just don't mess up. But he's proven that he can make plays. He's still, you know, really I have a top four, and I had to put somebody in that fifth spot. And I felt like Roethlisberger, because of his track record, is winning. And his ability to quarterback a team through the playoffs, I felt better about that than Vic. The reason I got Manning number one is for all the things that you've said. I love Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy is one of the guys, one of the most respected people, in my opinion. He's right up there with Coach John Thompson as far as one of the sports figures I respect the most. As far as being a coach, I don't know if he's on Bill Belichick's level as far as being a X's and O's coach. I think if Peyton Manning had that level of coaching, remember, Bill Belichick made Matt Castle look like a top 10 quarterback, which he is not. But Bill Belichick and that Patriot system made Matt Castle look unbelievable. So that's why I downgrade Brady a little bit. I think Brady benefits from a system around him. I view Brady much like I view Steve Nash. Steve Nash is a great player. Steve Nash is an awesome, has great vision. He's a great passer. You know, he's an excellent shooter. All those things I think translate wherever Steve Nash is. With Steve Nash, put up the numbers that Steve Nash is allowed to put up if he wasn't playing in that 6 seconds or less style of play. I don't think so. I don't think he would. And that's how I view Brady. If Brady wasn't in that system, I don't think, and he may not even be the quarterback that he is. Peyton Manning, I think if you put him on any team in the league, in any system to start out his career, he turns into a top five quarterback regardless. And so that's why I got paid first. Any questions?
I'm a little caught up with Roethlisberger. Big Ben has always been a tough one for me to quantify because he's been to three Super Bowls, I believe, correct? Like, he's been to three Super Bowls. He's won two Super Bowls. He's won two, and he's been to three, and he's only been playing for, what, 6 years, 7 years?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, I mean, that's impressive. That's very impressive. But I think I attribute, and I don't know if this is fair or not, but I attribute a lot of his success to the team that he's had around him, more so than the other guys on my list. Statistically, he hasn't put up a lot of quality numbers. I think if he did, and if he turned the ball over less, a lot of those close games that he's kind of been known for wouldn't be as close. You know what I mean? You think about these, you know, this defense he has in the playoffs, it's tough for teams to get 17 points against these guys. And you see the Steelers winning games 20-17, 21-17, 14-10. So anyway, I don't know if that's fair or not, but that's the reason I just haven't put Big Ben in my top five category. Now I know if Devon was on, he certainly would have something to say about that. But that's my issue with Ben.
And none of those points I would disagree with. Ben has benefited from having a strong defense year in and year out, from playing in a run-oriented system. But I think what that system allowed Ben to do was develop. I think that allowed him to grow into a quarterback who can win games with his arms. Does he always win the games with his arms? No. He's not always asked to do that because the Steelers have an identity that is going to exist beyond Big Ben. And I think, you know, because of that, they're going to stick to who they are and what they do because they know they have a brand and style of play that is successful. I agree with you. He has had some spots where he's looked shaky, where you think maybe they won some games in spite of him and maybe they lost some games because of him. I totally agree with you on that. But I feel more comfortable going into a game with him than I do Mike Vick at this point because I don't know if Vick is going to finish the game. I don't know necessarily what I'm going to get with Vic. So I feel I can more consistently count on what I'm going to get out of Big Ben, as opposed to what I'm going to get from Mike Vic.
So let me ask you this: of the second tier quarterbacks, who do you feel has the best shot of breaking into your top five in the next year or two?
So if I were to extend my list out to another five, you see Vic, Philip Rivers. I like Josh Freeman a lot, Matt Ryan, and I'm tempted, but I won't go there. Because I've watched him play, and he's really impressed me. And that's a kid like Matt Stafford. I don't know if I still – the longevity is always important to me. I still need to see some longevity. But Stafford's creeping right up in there. As far as going to that elite level, at this point, I would have to go with Stafford as being able to creep up into there. Because right now, right today – Stafford has got the weapons. He's got, and this is something that I had later in the rundown for today's show as a topic we could bring up during the freestyle, but I'm going to bring it up now. Megatron is a freaking monster. I mean, a flipping monster. Just an effing monster. I mean, I could see him breaking Randy Moss's receiving touchdowns record this year. He's got 6 in 3 games. I don't see that changing very much with the way their offense is structured. They got weapons around him. As long as Matt Stafford stays healthy, and that's the caveat with him, he's got to stay healthy. If he can stay healthy, I think he has the best shot of those guys I named in my second tier of moving up. I'm not really geeked about Phillip Rivers. I know a lot of people are really high on him. I've never been really geeked on Phillip Rivers just because he is like the bizarro Eli. Eli Manning somehow finds ways to win football games, and he's got a Super Bowl ring, and he's just ugly at it. Phillip Rivers hasn't won anything, but he looks damn good at not winning anything. And I think that's why those two players are always going to be connected to me, because Phillip Rivers looks great going out in the first round. Eli Manning looks terrible winning a Super Bowl. And so I'm not a big Rivers fan. I told you how I feel about Vic. Definitely not sold on Matt Ryan. And I like Josh Freeman. I think he needs more weapons. The Williams kid, Mike Williams kid out of Syracuse, receiver, is good. But I think they need to continue to put some more solid weapons around Josh Freeman and develop an offense that can put up some points. Because they have a setup where if they can get, you know, enough speed on the outside and a solid running game, that the defense in Tampa's coming along, you can see him taking that team pretty far. And he's got Moxie in the fourth quarter, which I give mad points for. But the guy who I think has the path of least resistance into my top five and who could replace Roethlisberger at that fifth spot. Because, again, I really got a top four, and I had to put somebody at five, and Big Ben made the most sense for me. If somebody could knock Big Ben at that fifth spot and really solidify my top five, it would be Matt Stafford at this point.
Yeah.
What say you, Sports PhD?
I'm going to go with Matt Schaub for the Houston Texans. The reason I think he's right, kind of on the outside of the top five, and kind of knocking on the door, I think he's got some tools around him that are first of all, going to win him games and get him in the playoff situations where we can truly see what he's about. First of all, he's got a solid defense. He's only been a couple of games into the season, but they look much improved. Even with giving up 40 points a couple of days ago to New Orleans, they still look a lot better than they did last year. And all defenses struggle from time to time. I mean, look at the Ravens. You know, 2 weeks out of the year, they look great. The third week, you know, or the second week, they look really bad. He's got a good running game around him, too. You know, we're seeing what Foster did last year. We're seeing what Ben Tate has been able to do this year, being a top five running back. So it almost looks like plug somebody into the system and they're going to do well. And I think to be a top five quarterback, at least to have the opportunity to get there, you've got to have some weapons around you that keeps the defense honest. You've got to have a decent defense that can get the other team off the field. And you've got to have a good running game that can, again, keep the defense honest and control the clock. And, again, we haven't even talked about Andre Johnson yet, who, you know, toss it up between him and Calvin Johnson. I mean, they're two of the top weapons in the game right now. And coming into the season, people would have called Arian Foster one of the top five or ten weapons in the league as well. So I think with all that being said, and, again, he's got a good tight end as well, I think he's got all the tools to do well. You know, we've seen Romo have these tools and not make it happen. And that's the reason why I didn't have him in my top five, nor did I have him, you know, as somebody who, you know, is at the precipice ready to break into the top five.
I'm with you on Romo. I'm not with you on Shaw. I'm not a fan. Not a fan of Shaw. I think he is what he's been. I think we've seen what he could be. I think his success from here on out is going to be about what's around him more than what he's doing. And I think that, for me, that's the difference between him and a Stafford. I think Stafford is, we've seen Calvin Johnson with other quarterbacks. And as good as he is, he hasn't been able to put up these kind of numbers. And I still think they're still getting used to each other. So, you know, they're not fully – they have great chemistry in the red zone, but between the 20s, they're still kind of connecting. But I think we've seen the best of Matt Schaub as far as being able to get he's good. Don't get me wrong. He's good. He's a very good quarterback, and he could take that team – deep into the playoffs. Absolutely. Absolutely. But is that going to be necessarily about anything that he's doing differently, or is that going to be more about the pieces around him? Because I think he's been good. I think he's as good as he's been. And he's been a second-tier quarterback right in that next level for the last 4 to 5 years. He's been right there. Him breaking through, I think, would be more about them finally, like you said, I think it would be more about them finally having a defense them finally having a sound identity as a team and a franchise. And I think that's also played a bit of a part in the lack of success that they've had as a team, is because this. I think sometimes people forget that's still a fairly new franchise, and it's still figuring out who they're going to be, what they're going to be about, and how they're going to win football games in a division with Peyton Manning, which isn't easy at all. So that's another piece that, you know, I think is looming over their heads. So I can see. I agree with you on Romo. I don't know about Charles, but this is the last one I'll throw out before we have our. We got a special treat coming for you guys. We're gonna get into some baseball as the baseball season's winding up. I'm gonna throw out this last question, and then we can lay the rest of five on the black hand side. So, who's your most overrated quarterback and why?
Romo. It's Romo. You know, I mean, you ever have a clear-cut choice, but then you can't get the words out to support that choice? that's me with Romo. I think about Brendan Haywood. Brendan Haywood, again, very random thought. And you might even remember this, Marcus, in college. Brendan Haywood was a solid basketball player in college. You know, here's a guy, he gave you 10 to 12 as far as rebounds, as far as points. He blocked some shots, you know, legitimate seven-footer, anchored the defense. But it was something about the guy I just didn't like in terms of his game. In college, when he was at North Carolina, you know, pros are just drooling. Oh, this guy's going to be a lottery pick. You know, I mean, again, if you can be 7 foot tall, chew gum, and walk at the same time, you know, typically you got a shot. But it was just something about him. I didn't like his coordination. I mean, it was just something about his game that just rubbed me the wrong way. This is where I come back to Tony Romo. It's something about his personality that just, you know, he doesn't fit the mold of what my idea, and evidently it's not just me, a lot of people feel this way, of what a leader is and what an elite quarterback is. And I think if he were playing in Cincinnati, we wouldn't look at him much different than what we did Carson Palmer. But because he's got that star on the side of his head, and for better or for worse, I mean, like the Yankees in baseball, the Cowboys are one of those two or three marquee franchises. So if you're the quarterback of the Cowboys, you know, we're going to be looking at you to perform at a different level. And last night during the game, I saw him get on a few of his young receivers as well as his center. And I kind of like that. You know, I kind of like seeing him being a little bit more aggressive. And it's not really fair to him because we don't know what happens behind closed doors. We don't. We don't know what kind of leader he is in the meeting room. We don't know. We just see what's on, you know, what happens on Sundays, and that's not really an accurate slice of what happens during the week. So, to me, I think Romo's overrated. All the talk that we've got over the last few weeks about him not being a marquee quarterback, I'm thinking to myself, I made this up 3 years ago. Why are we talking about it now?
Go ahead.
No. Go right ahead.
Romo was right there with me. I was right there with you on Romo. He was a guy I was definitely going to name as a guy that was definitely, definitely overrated. Another guy is Eli. And again, I think it's a product of where he plays. He plays in New York City. You know, and I think that plays a large role in a lot of the Eli hype. He's available in several of my fantasy leagues. You know, the Giants are decent year in and year out, but they're never great. Even the year that they won the Super Bowl, it was less about him, more about the defense, more about the run game, and the veteran leadership outside of him that took them to that win.
He still looks like he's trying to figure out how to be a quarterback and be a leader. And, you know, he's 6-7 years deep into his career. He should have that figured out by now. So that's the guy I think is majorly overrated, in my opinion. And right up there with Romo. And, again, I think a lot of that is attributed to the market that they play in. So.
And honestly, you know, I think Phillip Rivers got – Phillip Rivers is on the clock. He's on the clock, if you ask me. Because I don't think we can equate fantasy numbers with real-life numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when he's on the last 6-7 weeks of the season last year, he was the man. But let's not forget about the inconsistencies the first 7 or 8 weeks of the season.
Yep.
He's a big reason why they get off to slow starts.
Great.
Their defense has been solid. You know, you compare them to other defenses, there's no reason they need to start off 1-4, 2-6 every year. He turns the ball over a little bit too much for my taste. He misses some throws that 3-4 weeks later he makes consistently. And he's got the tools as well. So, I think Phillip Rivers is on the clock. And this time next year, if he has the same kind of season, we're going to start thinking about him like a Carmelo Anthony, somebody who puts up really nice numbers. They got a nice uniform, nice height. But where the W's at?
Where them dollars at, partner? Show
right.
me the money. Show me the money. All right, so that's the 5 on the black-hand side for this week's edition of The Real Sports Guys. Now we're going to transition. We got a special treat. And in order to set this up the way it needs to be set up, to break it down the way it needs to be broken down, I'm going to toss it to Sports PhD and let him go ahead and do his thing.
Yeah, we got a special treat tonight. We don't talk much baseball on the show. Myself, I grew up playing baseball. You know, high school, I'm playing 70, 80 games a summer. But somewhere along the lines, I kind of grew into just being an October baseball fan. I start to get interested in what's going on after the All-Star break. Really, when September rolls around, especially last couple of days of the season, that's when I start to really care about baseball. So we had to go to our bench. We had to bring in somebody who really knows the game. We're bringing in my man RJ Page, calling in from Michigan. Now, let me give you some background to RJ before we welcome him in. RJ is a true fan, okay, along the lines of a real sports guy that we talked about. My man holds it down professionally. He's a family man. This is a guy that gets out to the stadiums. I believe RJ is a season ticket holder to the Lions of Detroit, as well as the Tigers, as well as the Pistons. So we grew up in Michigan, but unfortunately I haven't stuck by the Lions side. I've come back to the Honolulu Blue, but I was kind of a here again, now again fan, but RJ is kind of stuck in through thick and thin. So how you doing tonight, RJ?
What's up, fellas?
Welcome to the show.
Good to have you on. Fellas, thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
Yeah. So let's just jump into some baseball talk, man. So for the fans not out there, that's listening or will be listening on the podcast later on this week, baseball is kind of hitting a hot spot right now. This is the next to last day of the season. We've got all the divisional races are wrapped up, but the wild cards are, like, wide open right now. Right now I'm watching St. Louis and Houston. St. Louis is up 2. Right now they're going into the night. They were tied up with the Braves for the NL wild card. And the Braves lost. So if the Cardinals can pull it out, they'll actually be a game up with 1 game to play. And then in the East, the Red Sox and the Devil Rays came into the night tied up.
I believe the Red Sox won. No, the Devil Rays won, and last I checked, the Red Sox were still playing. So RJ, we want to get your take on these two wild card races. Who you got and why?
Well, I think you said it, Phil. Now is the time to jump in. We'll correct one thing you mentioned. Actually, the Braves are one game up. So them losing today and assuming St. Louis holds on and pulls it out, they'll actually be tied.
All right.
Both of those squads have their aces going tomorrow. So it looks like there will actually be a playoff coming on Thursday if things hold as they should. But, you know, I don't see either of these teams making a run much past the wild card. It looks like both of them are trying to just give this thing up to whoever's still standing at the end will probably pull it out. So I don't think you guys want to spend much time on those two clubs. As far as the AL wild card spot, yeah, it's looking like this thing is going to go down to the end as well. Boston and Tampa Bay should be a good one, and I think, well, it looks like, I'm watching the game now, it looks like Baltimore has actually pulled one run closer. If they knock this thing up, then Tampa Bay will have the lead. But it looks like we'll probably have a playoff in that one as well, one-game playoff on Thursday. Because the Yankees really are trying to give this thing to Tampa Bay. Is what it looks like. They've got they don't know who's pitching tomorrow, and Tampa Bay has David Price going. So it pretty much looks like Tampa Bay is going to walk right into a one-game playoff if Boston can do what they are supposed to do, which is asking a lot. They've been dropping a lot of ball games lately.
Yeah. So what's your thought on that? You know, I've always kind of went back and forth in terms of hot teams going into the playoffs. Are they more dangerous? Are they less dangerous? Versus, you know, teams that are kind of sputtering into the playoffs like the Red Sox. And those who don't know, the Red Sox, they had a 7 or 8 game lead in the wild card standings, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they lost it. And in baseball terms, in any sport, lose 9 games in a month. In terms of a lead, I mean, that's just horrible. So, I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of if the Devil Rays get in, where they've been relatively hot the last month, they've kind of cooled down a little bit the last couple of days, do you think they would be more of a dangerous team, or do you think the Red Sox would be in terms of them sputtering to the playoffs?
Well, to answer your first question, typically regular season performance and teams on hot streaks and cold streaks, that typically does not carry over to the playoffs. And we can look at where you are, Phil, in 06. The Cardinals were one of the worst teams coming into the playoffs. I think they backdoored themselves in. They ended up beating the Tigers in the World Series. So typically that type of performance does not carry over. That being the case, Boston has a lot of injuries on their pitching staff. And I think that's the reason for a lot of the reason for this downfall. So if they are able to get in, I don't see them making much noise. Tampa Bay, on the other hand, everybody's healthy, and, it's just a matter of them clicking right now. So, if they do slide in, they could be a dangerous team. Again, I don't see them, doing much. Their lineup doesn't have enough punch for me. But, they could be a dangerous team. They play some great defense, have some good pitchers. I'm just not seeing it out of either of these teams.
Well said. All right, now before we get into the playoff picture, let's veer away for a second. So again, as I mentioned, I know you go to a lot of the Tigers games, season ticket holder, so you've had the opportunity to see Justin Verlander do his thing all year. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a big discussion whether or not he should be. Well, obviously he's eligible, but should he be voted to be the MVP? And game changer, I'm going to get your opinion on this as well, just in terms of the concept of should pitchers be considered to be in the MVP race, considering they already have their own award, the Cy Young.
Right.
So, RJ, I want to get your take on that issue and then also a more specific issue situation on Verlander in terms of his impact and success with the Tigers. And, again, do you think he should be considered for the MVP?
Okay. I'm typically not a big pitcher for MVP guy. I do kind of fall in line with pitchers get the Cy Young, MVP goes to the best everyday player. That being the case, I will make some concessions for a pitcher winning the MVP. And
okay.
this is a funny year, and I'm not being a homer here. You know, he's a Detroit guy, and I'm not being a homer. I don't even know if I would vote for him. But if there was
it's
any
okay
year,
to be a homer, as long as you claim it, it's okay to be a homer.
if there was ever a year that the pitcher could win the MVP, this would be the year. You don't have, you know, the stand above everyday player, the standout guy who you can point to and say he's the MVP. So, you know, Verlander wouldn't be robbing anybody of an MVP vote. If there were a year, I think this was the year. This would be the year. That being the case, I think Verlander may have lost a lot of the national media pub when he didn't win his 25th game. You know, these baseball writers love these round numbers, 25 games. No one has really won 25 games in a long time. But, you know, I haven't been hearing his name as much since he lost that his last game. Or, I don't want to say lost, since he got a no decision in that last game.
Yeah.
So that answers your question, Phil.
Oh, yeah, you nailed it. What do you think about it, Marcus?
Yeah, I fall in that same camp. Pitchers don't play every day. Again, just my orientation to sports, I feel like an MVP needs and has to impact the performance of his team on a daily basis for me to really truly feel like that they are the most valuable piece to that team. For a guy who comes out, you know, every fourth, every fifth day and, you know, is amazing. Verlander does his thing, hands down. He's an excellent pitcher. But, again, that everyday impact I don't see. So in the essence of the award, when you're talking about the most valuable player, is he the most valuable piece on that team? Possibly. Possibly. I think it always raises an interesting conversation when you have a pitcher who's been as dominant as Verlander. But again, for me, it's really hard to move past the idea that he doesn't play every day, excuse me. So I usually kind of trend towards, again, unless the pitcher is just unbelievable and is doing things that haven't been done at the position before, then I kind of stay away from considering a pitcher as a potential MVP.
See, I guess I'm on the opposite end. So because I think a pitcher should be seriously considered for the MVP. I mean, name me one position in the sports that we discuss on this show, team sports, one position that has more impact on a game, regardless of the sport, than a pitcher. And in the word of Cat Williams, I wait. Quarterback.
Not to nerd up this show or go too deep into history, but actually the first MVP was a pitcher. I believe it was Alec Grover Alexander, if memory serves me correctly, but I do know it was a pitcher. So there is some precedence for a pitcher winning the MVP.
Okay. All right.
And like I said, I think this would be the year where I would actually consider it.
Okay.
Just to answer your question, Phil, I would say quarterback. But I agree with you. I agree with you that Verlander has an enormous effect on the game when he's out there, but he's only out there every fifth day.
Right.
And that's the catch for me. Like, that's the hook for me. If he's only out there every fifth day. Out of a 162-game season, that's a lot of games where he's not on the field for his team. That's a hell of a chunk of this schedule where he's not on the field for his team.
The flip.
That's why I agree with you. I agree with you. A pitcher is extreme. That's why the Giants won the World Series last year. It's because they had an amazing pitching staff, and their pitchers stepped up in the playoffs, and they had an amazing run. So I agree with you. The impact of a pitcher is like very few other positions. The only other position I think in sports that has that much of an impact. Maybe a goalie in hockey, but we don't talk about hockey on this show. But maybe a goalie in hockey, a quarterback in and a quarterback in football. That's about it as far as the impact of one player on a game. But again, he goes out there once a week.
Yeah,
the
flip to that argument, Phil, I know you're a Yankees guy. Say you want to give it to Curtis Granderson. I mean, baseball is a sport where, you know, there's nine guys on the field. How often is Curtis just standing around out there? I mean, he's probably getting, what, 3 to 4 bats a game? So, you know, how much of an impact is he having on the game?
Right.
There is an actual stat that tries to measure the impact guys have on the field. You know, I delve into these advanced stats a little bit, so stop me if I'm going over anybody's head here. But there's a stat called WAR, which is wins above replacement. And basically they try to find the amount of wins that any one player is responsible for over a replacement player. Say, you know, you just throw out some everyday Joe Schmo versus Justin Verlander. And Verlander actually leads the league in WAR based on, you know, pitchers and batters. He has an 8.6 WAR. The closest guy to him is Jose Bautista, plays every day, hit 42 home runs this year. He's at 8.5. So with these advanced stats, Justin Verlander does lead the AL in wins above replacement.
Okay.
Learn something new.
Right. I mean, Paige is bringing it, okay? Now, RJ, I hate to do this to you, man. I hate to do this to you. But you brought up something, Curtis Granderson. You know, people call the Yankees the evil empire. I got to get your thoughts on when you lost Granderson a couple of years ago to the Yankees from the Tigers. I know you're a big Tiger fan. Just share your thoughts on that. And it is okay to cuss on the radio. It is if you need to let one out.
Yeah, believe it or not, I'm gonna keep it cool. Granderson's a great guy, great player. Loved having him here, but I understand the move. I understand it. I'm okay with it. I don't think anybody saw what Curtis was gonna do this year. I mean, he's playing out of his mind. But Austin Jackson, you know, he's up and down. He's a great defender, and, you know, here at Comerica Park, we have that big outfield, and I've seen that guy run down balls that nobody, Granderson included, could get to. And in that park, you know, you need somebody like that who can get you as many outs as possible. So I understand the move. That doesn't mean I was happy when it happened.
All right.
Yeah, I still got my Granderson photos up. I still got the autographs. Batting gloves, so I'm still a fan, and it hurt, but I get it.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, you're taking the high road there, Paige. I appreciate that about you. You're taking the high road.
I think my dad might be listening, so I'm going to keep from cursing.
Right. Shout out to Mr. Paige in North Carolina.
How to keep from crying.
Right. Shout out to Mr. Paige in North Carolina. So I was thinking earlier in the weekend, this past weekend, about, you know, in preparation to have RJ on, like what were some of my favorite teams, baseball teams, that I actually saw during my generation. And I want to get you guys' thoughts as well. But my favorite team, and, I mean, there's a lot to pick from. You know, growing up in Michigan, the 84 Tigers, you know, I was 7 or 8 years old. They stick out, the Cubs that made the playoffs for the first time, who knows how long, in 89 with Sandberg and Dawson, they stick out. But my favorite team would probably have to be those Oakland Athletic teams in the late 80s and early 90s. So this was a team where they won the World Series in 89 against the San Francisco Giants. That was the Earthquake World Series, I believe. And, I mean, this was a team, they were just loaded. As far as pitchers, they had three or four,
I mean, they were almost like the Philadelphia Phillies, but before the Philadelphia Phillies were their pitching staff. And then they had this big dog closer at Eckersley, who I believe was the last pitcher to actually win the MVP, or if not the last, he's been one of the most recent few that have won the MVP as a closer and as a pitcher in general. But this team had Ricky Henderson, and Ricky Henderson was swag before they started calling it swag. I mean, this was a dude that could hit for power. He ran the bases. He was cocky. I mean, he just got it done. They had other guys like Canseco, a real skinny, young and skinny Mark McGwire, okay? Kearney Lansford, Dave Henderson, Dave Parker. I mean, they were just loaded. So for me, I remember, like, that was the first team when I watched them. You were surprised that they lost the game, you know. And in baseball, you win 100 games and lose 62. I mean, that's a pretty good season. But whenever they were on TV, I mean, you were just actually surprised when somebody made a out because that's just how dominant they were, or at least it seemed like they were as a kid. So I'll kick it to you, Marcus. Who's your favorite baseball team?
Glad you asked, brother. As a Southside of Chicago kid, I was a major baseball fan as a child growing up. To the point where, you know, Game Changer had a rough upbringing. There were times where we didn't have a TV in the house for financial reasons, but I would listen to the White Sox on the radio. And my favorite team was the 1993 Chicago White Sox. A roster where they had Bo. They had Bo Jackson. Carlton Fisk was still on the team back then. Bobby Thigpen was the closer. Jack McDowell. They had a young Wilson Alvarez. Just a lot of good pieces. Lance Johnson was my favorite player, the one dog out in center field. Just a really fun team to watch, to listen to hear about, and to follow. They won first place in AL West. I think they won, I don't know the exact number, they won 90-some games that year. And, you know, Ozzie Guillen was playing shortstop. I mean, just a fun team. Young Frank Thomas, you know, Big Hurt, one of my favorite players. Just a really strong team. Really deep team, and they wind up losing, broke my heart, lost to the Blue Jays in the ALCS, and, you know, we missed that opportunity to go to the World Series, but then they picked it up and got it in 05, which was great. But I wasn't nearly, at that point in my life, I wasn't nearly as viscerally connected to the White Sox team as I was back when I was a kid. The 05 championship was sweet, but, again, it wasn't a team that I followed like I followed that 93 team.
All right. So who you taking, RJ?
Oh, man, I couldn't choose two, Phil. You get don't kill me. I couldn't choose two. I tried to balance it out, but as far as characters, I couldn't leave off the 86 Mets. You know, just watching those guys come on the field and dare you to try to beat them. You know, they knew that they were beating whoever was in their way. They had, you know, Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden throwing K's, Lenny Dykstra. I mean, these guys were getting in bar fights, doing drugs. I mean, they just had characters out the ass. I mean, I remember I went to a game where they were actually playing the Cubs, and Daryl Strawberry promised to autograph a ball for me after the game. And so, you know, I'm waiting around. I think we waited about a half hour, and I couldn't believe this guy didn't come back. And, you know, in my older years, I can charge it up to his habit. But I just could not believe at that age that this guy told me he was coming back to sign an autograph, had me waiting for a half hour, and never came through. So I love the 86 Mets. And then in my adult life, I'd have to go with the 06 Tigers. I mean, that was my first season having season tickets. You know, they took me through a range of emotions. The last day of the season, they couldn't seal the deal. They lost the division and slid into the playoffs on a wild card. I remember seeing grown men in the stands crying because we knew we were going to have to play the Yankees. Everybody thought it was over. You know, I'm at every game in the playoffs. I saw us beat the Yankees. Couldn't believe it. Champagne parties on the field with the fans. You know, I had Zamaya coming dousing me with champagne while I'm in the crowds cheering and going crazy. I remember the Maglio home run against the A's. It's like it was yesterday to win the ALCS. When Maglio came up to bat, I actually was telling somebody sitting next to me, I'm like, he's not gonna do anything. He's gonna hit a single. Next thing I know, the ball's traveling out of the yard. I'm looking like an idiot. Everybody around this point is going crazy. But the ALCS that year was I was actually on TV that year as well. They caught me waving my towel on TV. So that was a real memorable season. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention also it was the first time me and my dad got to go to a World Series game together that year. So that was a good one for me.
Wow. So you bring in the 06 Tigers and the 86. Yeah, those 86 Mets. Especially, I recently read a book about the 86 Mets. I mean.
Oh, you read that one?
Those guys. Yeah, I read that book. I mean, those guys were off the chain, man. They was all over the place.
Yeah, I finished that book in a couple of days. And that was a good one.
Yeah, that was a good read. So, I mean, Mark just kind of touched on a little bit earlier in terms of how he was connected to baseball as a kid, but it's kind of grown away from it. You know, I mean, I think this is a good issue for us to dig in. You know, all three of us are African-Americans around the same age. RJ, you know, you and I, when we was coming up playing baseball in Little League, I mean, even back then in the 80s, there weren't a ton of African-Americans playing, you know. And by the way, I'd like to mention that RJ's dad had a powerhouse at Westwood Little League. I think they won like 5 straight championships, okay? They had a powerhouse with 7- and 8-year-olds.
Don't forget they were undefeated, too.
But right, undefeated, okay, in Little League. But, you know, it just seems like, you know, I was looking at a stat of a report that was put together a couple of years ago that I always come back to where we saw a sharp increase in African-American ball players, you know, in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, and they kind of plateaued in the 80s where it was African-Americans were almost the majority in baseball. Where you look at it now, Latino players are the biggest minority in baseball, and right now African-Americans are actually, believe it or not, competing with Asian-born players in terms of being the second minority in baseball. And so just kicking around, you know, a real sports guy's, you know, flavor, I just want to get y'all's take on why is it, like, we don't see as many African-Americans playing baseball over the past 20 years to the point now where you can literally turn on the game and maybe not see an African-American playing. Sometimes I'll watch games with my wife, you know, and I'll mention this, and she'll say, well, what about him? I'm like, no, that's Mariano Rivera. Just wait for him to talk. You'll know he's not African-American. but when I watch the Phillies, you know, you got Ryan Howard, you got Jay Rose, you know, you got a couple of guys there, but in general, you don't see a ton of African Americans out there playing, especially back in the 80s. You know what I mean? They dominated a lot of ball clubs. So what are you guys' thoughts on that? We'll start with Marcus.
This is what I'll do. I'll just ask you to close your eyes. Close your eyes. Visualize the typical inner city neighborhood. And as you're touring this imaginary inner city neighborhood in your head, what I then would like you to do is point out the patch of baseball diamond and tell me where that's located. And I think, to me, that's at the crux of it. It's easy for me as an inner-city kid to go find a basketball goal, a slab of concrete, and shoot hoops. It's much more difficult to, one, find a space for kids. And I think that's where kids develop that love for a sport, is when they play it in unstructured settings. So where can I go and play baseball and practice baseball in an unstructured way? In most inner cities, there aren't a whole lot of avenues for kids. especially kids who don't have a lot of money, to go out and play baseball. And then on top of that, you got to find, like, a couple friends. It's not something you can necessarily do by yourself, you know, and to really mimic what happens on a baseball diamond in August or July, you got to know, like, 19, 20 other people. And y'all all got to be willing to roll out there and get it in at the same time. And so I think some of those kind of factors, but I think the main factor is informal opportunity to participate has gone down majorly in inner cities. And I think if you want to get inner city kids participating in a sport, there have to be informal opportunities for them to participate, whether it be them and a bunch of buddies going out and shooting hoops or throwing around a football, or, you know, or whatever. But I think if for that particular segment of the population, there has to be informal opportunities for them to play and practice, because it's not like, you know, in a suburb or in a middle class area where you're going to have parents who are able to truck kids around the games, who are able to get kids back and forth to practices, who are able to get kids a bunch of equipment. So there has to be an investment of some sort to create space, which there has been, and I'm sure you guys will get into that momentarily, but an investment to create space and provide opportunity and equipment. And I think that's maybe 10 to 15 years we'll see some of the fruit of that investment begin to bear itself in the major leagues. But even then, you know, you have more kids playing, but, you know, 1% to 2%, less than 1% of those kids are going to make it to the majors. So it's still a long road to go, but it's a start.
Wow.
All right, yeah, well said.
I think Marcus hit the nail on the head for, you know, for me to try to there's a myriad of issues that, you know, we could be talking about this for hours. But I think it really does boil down to access. And, I mean, Marcus hit all the key points on the head. But that being the case, we also, Major League Baseball has a role to play in this as well. You know, they don't market their African-American players to inner-city children in the same sense and fashion that, you know, NBA does. Look at the success the NBA has in the urban areas. You know, you got LeBron on TV. Every other second, you know, you got a big game coming on Christmas Day, you know, they've got LeBron on the TV throwing a pass to Kobe, and it's bouncing off the backboard to Magic. You know, NBA markets their stars, and Major League Baseball, for some reason, just chooses not to do that. They market the team. And, you know, they play a big part in this. You talked about baseball fields in the inner city, and I flew to, Puerto Rico one time. And, you know, as I'm flying over the city, I could not count the number of baseball fields that I saw. It was like, it had to be at least 8 fields. And we all know that, you know, Latin American players are dominating the league right now. And why is that? Major League Baseball has set up camps. Pretty much every team now has a camp in various Latin American countries where they are just funneling children to these camps. They don't go to school, or they get very little schooling, I should say, and pretty much they play baseball all day. It costs the teams next to nothing to run these camps, and, you know, whenever these kids are ready, they're signing them for a bag of chips and a Faygo. So Major League Baseball, if they wanted to, could do something.
Faygo, that's Michigan, baby. Faygo.
I was going to say, that's the first real sports guy's Faygo reference.
That's right. Faygo, bringing it. Going right ahead, Paige.
But that being the case, MLB, if they wanted to do something about the issue and they wanted parks in the hood, they could build them, and I believe people would eventually come. I mean, they built one in L.A., it's a baseball academy, reviving baseball in the inner city, but that's really, one is not enough. So,
You know? Now, before we get too deep into this, I want to bring in a couple. We have a couple callers on the line. We got Ray checking in with us. Ray must have stepped away. We got another caller on the line. Carl, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, man. What's up?
What's up? Who we got? This is L-Dog?
Yeah, this is L-Dog, man.
What's poppin', man?
Hey, man, it's going good, but this conversation kind of hit home with me because I'm one of these guys. I mean, y'all know my stature, right? I'm tailor-made to be a baseball player. Part of my issue growing up was the economics of playing baseball. I come from a family who didn't have the means. I'm the one that had no TV like you, Mark. And, you know, part of the issue is that when I looked at it and said, I need a new bat, I need a bag, I need gloves, I need all this stuff, I couldn't even go to my mom with a straight face and say, Mom, I need to play baseball and I need all this stuff. Like, that don't happen, you know, in most inner city scenarios, I would say. That's a big deal. You know, basketball is one ball. You go out, you throw it out, and the guys recreate, as they say. Football, same thing. It's one ball, you go play, whatever. Baseball is a whole different story from an economic standpoint. Like now, I have a son. You know, thank God we do well enough. He can play, but he's in T-ball, and we spend probably $100-something on equipment in T-ball. So it's a big difference for inner-city kids to even want to play baseball from that aspect. So I just wanted to bring that point to you guys, coming from my point of view. So, but that's it.
All right. Yeah, appreciate it. Appreciate the perspective.
Yeah, that's a good point of view,
Larry. And that doesn't even mention the summer leagues that, you know, most of these white kids that make it to the major leagues, you know, they're playing in summer leagues and travel ball. That can cost you $300-$400 just to get a spot on the team, not let alone the travel included. So there definitely is an economic gap that needs to be filled.
Yeah, because baseball is one of those sports where, I mean, it's almost like golf or tennis, where there's so much technique and fundamentals required that if you don't get in on it, you know, before the age of 10 or 11, you know, I mean, some would even argue younger, it's tough to catch up with it and kind of just play for the first time in the ninth grade when you get to high school. I mean, it's almost impossible where you can see a raw athlete come out on the football field, never playing organized sports, and all of a sudden he's taken off, he or she's taken off. Or, you know, we see this a lot in basketball. But, you know, in sports that require this kind of technique, I mean, baseball, that's almost unheard of. Baseball almost has its own little culture. You know, my brother, he played Division I baseball. You know, a lot of my friends, like myself, including RJ, we played baseball throughout high school. And it was always like a certain group of guys. You know, the guys that we played with as in Little League, this was say two or three guys we played with all the way through high school pretty much, you know, in terms of African-Americans on the team. And it's almost like this culture where your parents kind of need to understand it because oftentimes you're facing racism at a very early age. You know, I mean, I think about it when I was 10 or 11 playing on travel teams. You know, I was kind of used to it because my brother had went through it 10 years before me and my parents were a little bit, you know, kind of conditioned to it. But, you know, I mean, this was in the 80s and 90s, but that's kind of tough for a kid, you know, an African-American, to be the only one on the team. And I know for me, and perhaps RJ can speak to this, you know, that helped me out later on in life in terms of fitting in, you know, being the only African-American in the classroom or being the only racial minority in the corporate world a lot of times. That kind of helped me and insulated me to get used to the experience that helped me later on in life.
I was a bit militant in high school, so I don't know that it helped me as much as it helped you, Phil. I was carrying Malcolm X books in high school. I don't know about that.
Right. Right. RJ was on something else. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Now, before we jump into our NFL picks, we got one more, a few more minutes here on baseball. So, especially we got RJ on the line. You know, we just want to get your feel on, you know, the, you know, probably the top two teams you see in each league, and then who you think is going to make it to the World Series.
Oh man, I for me, the playoffs are all about pitching and defense. I mean, look at last year. We had the Giants. Giants win it all, and I'm a baseball fanatic, and I could probably name you five or six of their hitters. I dare anybody else to name one or two. But that being the case, I'm going with everybody's obvious choice, Philly, and I think Texas is going to make it this year.
Okay.
Philly is all about the pitching for me. I mean, Roy Halladay, Cole Hamels, Cliff Lee, good night, pretty much. Everybody thinks Philly is a power slugging team, but I mean, a lot of their hitters have actually regressed this year. They got a old ball club. I mean, Ryan Howard isn't doing what Ryan Howard does. Chase Utley's hurt. He hasn't put up a Chase Utley type season. Jimmy Rollins is on the wrong side of 30. He's definitely regressing. And what you look at the records that they have. I mean, they won what 100 some odd games with
yeah.
Everybody in regression. I mean, good luck beating those guys. And then Texas, I mean, they just got power. They're power personified. Everybody in their lineup, 1-9, can pretty much hit. And believe it or not, they have a damn good pitching staff as well. I mean, Nolan Ryan has done some awesome things with that staff. He's got guys. He's got those guys ready. So I see this being a Texas-Philly World Series this year.
Now, I know it must have pained you to leave your Tigers out. What is it about the Tigers that you don't think they have it to get to that next level?
I'm just trying real hard not to be on. I think they can do it, but the back end of the rotation scares me. We've all seen, you know, Arizona in 01, what you can do with two pitchers, Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson. And I think Detroit has those two pitchers in Verlander and, surprisingly, Doug Fister, a guy they picked up just before the trade day.
Right. Who's that?
Yeah, I know. Guy they got from Seattle. And, you know, I was doing a little prep for your show. And, you know, I looked up some stuff. And actually, Doug Fister has posted a 2.94 ERA this year. And Curt Schilling, the year Arizona did the thing in 01, posted a 2.98 ERA. I mean, the guy's been throwing lights out. Nobody's heard of him. But, I mean, I think he gives the Tigers that Randy Johnson, Curt Schilling front end of the rotation. The last two guys in the rotation scare me, and that was what kept me from picking my Tigers to make it to the World Series.
I got a lot of respect for you, not to ride with the home team, looking at things objectively. A lot of respect for you. It's been real nice having you on, RJ. We're going to kick it over to the Pick Six. Feel free to hang out with us and pitch on in with the NFL picks if you have time. But
yeah,
I really appreciate you having.
Everybody still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah,
we're
still here.
We're
going to kick it over to you, Marcus.
All right, got it. All right, here we go. All right, so, yeah, time for the Pitch Six, weekly segment that we do on the show. Before we get into this week's picks, we got to recap last week's picks. Let me pull them up real quick, see how everybody did. All right, so let me get my abacus out real quick and calculate and add these up real quick. So last week's pick six, we had the Philly New York game. Everybody went Philly. Everybody's taking the L on that one. We had the Green Bay Chicago game. Phil's taking another L on that one. Everybody else went Green Bay. We had the New Orleans Houston game, Ray and D. Wills both went with New Orleans. Me and Phil took Houston, so we taking L's there. Then in our college games, we had the Alabama-Arkansas game, Clemson-LSU, and then the last game was Florida State and West Virginia. No, West Virginia and Clemson and Florida State and West Virginia and LSU. And so for that one, we all had Alabama, or except Phil. He took Arkansas, so he's taking the L on that one.
I'm coming back down from Earth. I was doing
so you was at night. Yeah, I don't know if you're going to – yeah, we're going to see if you're still in first place. You gave up quite a few games last week. We had Clemson, Florida State game, Devon and Ray both had Clemson. Phil T and I had Florida State. And for the LSU-West Virginia game, for some reason I took West Virginia. Ray took West Virginia. Phil T and D. Wills took LSU. So let me tabulate this up real quick. So last week, at the end of last week's, I was sitting at 6-6. Phil T was at 9-3, and D. Wills was at 7-5. So D. Wills last week walked away with 5 victories.
He's cleaning up.
Yeah, he got us. he got us a little bit. So he got 5 out of the 6. So he's at 12-6 right now after 3 weeks. D-New, Phil T, you took an L with Philly. You took an L with Chicago, Arkansas, Florida State. You came up with LSU. So you scored with LSU. So you went 1-5 last week, Cat Daddy.
Damn.
So you went from 9-3 to 10-8.
Right. Call me the Boston Red Sox. Call me the Red Sox.
Right. Talk about a collapse.
Right.
So I came in the last week at 6-6. I got a win with Green Bay and Alabama. So I went 2-4 last week. So I'm still bringing up the rear at 8-10. So I'm at 8-10. So D. Wills is holding down. I know he's somewhere listening to this chuckling because we all like to be right.
Right.
So I'm going to see if I can gain some ground this week in the pick six. We got 3 NFL games, 3 college football games. We're going to get into them real quick and see where we wind up picking. Hopefully, B. Wills can get his pick to me at some point. We'll get those up on the Facebook page so we can all keep track. All right. So this week, first game, NFL, we got the New York Jets at the Baltimore Ravens. And I wish Devon was here because I told Joe Flacco stuff in his face. Because Flacco balled last week. Devon's a Steelers fan. And last week, I meant to call him on his Flacco hate, but I let it ride. Because he was hating on Flacco. And I was like, man, you just saying that because you're a Steelers fan. And they beat the brakes off the Steelers in week one. But, you know, he can't stand Flacco. Flacco ball last week. Baltimore got a win. So I'll weigh in first on this one. I'm going with Baltimore at home. I don't expect Flacco to be great. I expect him to find a middle ground. The Jets are real shaky to me. Their running game isn't what it should be. Sean Green, I can't figure him out. Every now and then he looks like a great back, but those times where he looks great are few and far between. The Jets' defense doesn't look as strong as it's looked in the past. It seems to be vulnerable. They don't have the run-stuffing element that they had in past years with their front four or their front three. And in their front seven, they don't seem to be stopping the run like they used to. And that's taking away those opportunities for them to blitz the way they like to blitz and to get after the quarterback the way they like to get after the quarterback. So I'm going with Baltimore. Their defense is still always what it has been. And I think they're gonna cause problems for Sanchez. So I'm going with Baltimore in that game. Phil T.
I'll keep it short and sweet because a lot of your thoughts about the Ravens are very similar to mine. I think these two teams are
are a lot closer than what people are giving credit to. But I'm going to go with Baltimore because they're at home.
Okay. All right. And RJ, who you taking?
You know, I'm going to go with Baltimore as well. I think Oakland with Darren McFadden gave Baltimore the blueprint, and I think Ray Rice is going to have a field day on him.
All right. Excellent. So the next game, this is kind of a something's got to give matchup here. We have the Minnesota, the 0-3 Minnesota Vikings, who have given up the last 2 weeks 17-plus point leads in the second half and have been outscored, I think it was like 76-6 in the second half of their first three games, which is pretty ridiculous, versus the 0-3 Kansas City Chiefs, who just look a little lost. Jamal Charles is out for the season. They lost Eric Berry for the season. They're injury riddled. They're struggling to begin with, on top of the injuries. So something's got to give here. Somebody's going to come away 0-4, and somebody's going to walk away with their first win in the season. Who's it going to be? PhD.
When I saw this game on the rundown, I'm like, what is Marcus thinking? Minnesota, Kansas City? it's like the toilet bowl.
It is.
But I actually think Minnesota's a much better team than their 0-3 record indicates. Well, not much better, maybe 1-2. I'm going to go with Minnesota in a close one.
Okay. So you're taking Minnesota on the road. RJ,
I see
which way you going?
Close to 2. I see it being real close. So close it's going to go to overtime. Nobody's going to score in overtime, and in the end, Donovan McNabb will have to explain the overtime rule to Matt Patrick.
So RJ's going with a tie. So they both remain winless. I like that scenario.
Wow.
I like that. Loving it. I'm going to go with Minnesota in this matchup as well. I do think Minnesota is slightly better than they performed. I think if they can figure out how to just hang on to leads and realize that you have the best back in the league, and one of the best ways to win a game when you are up by 17-plus points is to just run the ball down the other team's throat. And when you got the best back in the league, you should probably try doing that more often. So I'm going to go with Minnesota in this situation. I think Kansas City is just too depleted to really – I think it's going to be a close game. Minnesota's going to make some mistakes. Kansas City's going to capitalize on those mistakes, but Kansas City's going to make just as many mistakes, and I think that Minnesota finally gets on the board. I think they're the better team of the two, even though Kansas City is at home. So I'm going with Minnesota. All right, game 3. We got Honolulu Blue, the Detroit Lions, the undefeated Detroit Lions, rolling into the house that Jerry built down there in Dallas to take on America's team. This is another one of those big games for Detroit. Last week was a big one. Last week was one of those moments that really can galvanize a young locker room. Even though this is, and I don't know how well known this is, Detroit has one of the oldest teams in the league. You think of them as a young upstart team. They're one of the oldest teams in the league. Look it up.
I didn't even know that one.
Look it up. I saw it. I think early last week I saw it because they were saying that the Packers are the second youngest team in the league, and I was like, still the youngest, one of the youngest teams in the league. And they ran down all of the NFC North teams, and Detroit was either 30 or 31
wow.
in the league as far as age. So I'm sure they have a lot of veterans on the in their front seven, maybe some veteran backups. I don't know, but when you think of Detroit, you think of them as a young team, but in actuality, they're not that young. So I just thought I'd throw that out there for the listeners. RJ, I'm going to let you weigh in first on this one. Who you got?
Do you have to ask? I'm going with Detroit here. Dallas on a short week. They couldn't score a touchdown against the Redskins at home, mind you. weak offensive line going up against Sue, Corey Williams. I'm hearing rumbles that Nick Fairley's going to play. I think they're going to get to Romo. There's no Miles Austin in this one. You got Dez Bryant playing playing half hurt or half uninspired. I don't know what he's doing, but he's not a factor. I think everything's pointing to Detroit on this one.
All right. All right. Phil T. Oh, I'll take this one first. I'm going. Yeah, I got to go Detroit as well. I can't buy Dallas. I just can't buy Dallas. I'm going with the Lions on this one also. So I'm going Lions. Like I said, I like Stafford, and I still think as good as they've been, especially in the red zone, he and Calvin Johnson, he and Megatron still haven't quite got on the same page yet. And when they do, look out. Just look out.
Watch out.
Yeah. Phil T.
You guys pretty much nailed it home and then took away the hammer. So there's not a whole lot left to say. I'm going to ride with the Lions as well. I like the Lions in the blowout, actually.
Okay. So that was a pretty easy pro pick six. The college football games this week, this is where we're going to earn our money this week, in my opinion. This is where we're going to earn our money right here. We got, for the college football games, we got Nebraska at Wisconsin. They're coming up here to Madison. They're coming up here, first Big Ten game, under the lights. Students are going to be drunk out their mind because they're going to be drinking all day. Because if you don't know how they get down up here in Madison, as soon as college game day comes on at 9 or 10 a.m. or whatever time it come on, that's when the drinks start flowing. And they flow until game time. And if you ever have watched a televised game of the Wisconsin Badgers at home at Camp Randall, you will notice that the student section usually doesn't fill up until about midway through the second quarter because they still drinking. They drank so much that they forgot what they was drinking for, which was the game. And then they show up to the game late. So that's how they get down here in Madison. I'm going with the Badgers in this one. Taking it to Nebraska. And if you haven't seen the boy Russell Wilson, the boy can ball. They finally got a quarterback. And I'm still doing the research. I'm still trying to figure out if this is the first African-American quarterback at the University of Wisconsin. They haven't said that yet. They haven't come out and said that. But this is a liberal town, and sometimes liberals don't like to forget stuff like that. So I'm taking Wisconsin in that one. Fealty, who you got?
I'm taking the Badgers too, man. I'm all in on Russell Wilson. I'm all in on him.
All right. RJ, who you taking?
The Wisconsin in the close one.
All right. So we all on the Badgers. All right, we got to speed through these next ones because we're running out of time. Alabama at Florida. Bill T, who you taking?
Bama. Roll Tide.
RJ, who you got?
Roll Tide.
All right, I'm going Florida at home. I'm gonna go the other way on that one. I'm going to take the home squad. I may pay for that one, but I'm going to go ahead and see if I can gain a game real quick. Then we got Texas A&M and Arkansas. Here's the SEC matchup.
I like A&M.
A&M on the road. RJ.
That was me, A&M.
A&M. I'm taking Arkansas at home again, see if I can get a game up on you. All right. That's it. That's all we got. We run out of time. You know, holding you down here. We got about 15 seconds left. Be cool. Any parting shots? Any dope lines for the people out there?
Hey, my dog of the week is Russ Welker. He won me a week in Fantasy World, 68 points.
Nice. Oh, yeah. My dog of the week has to be Megatron. I'm loving this dude. 6 touchdowns in 3 games. I don't have him on any of my fantasy teams, but I wish I did. And I'm loving the way he's playing. I think he's raising his game to another level. He's right in there with the Andre Johnsons and the Roddy Whites as far as being one of those top 3 to 5 receivers in the league. So RJ, you got a dog of the week for us?
I didn't prepare one, but why not? Coastal Carolina football coach. If you haven't seen it, YouTube it. Need more dogs.
We need more dogs. Be a dog.
There it is.
We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
Oh, man, we're going to leave it on that. We need more dogs. Always, always need more dogs. That's another episode of The Real Sports Guys in the books. For all you listeners out there, feel free to catch us next week, Tuesday, 8:30 to 10:30. Holla.
Peace.
Hello?
Yeah, we are. Hello?
Okay. You still there, RJ?
No, I think he's gone.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool, cool. So good show, man. Good show. Thanks for pulling them in, man. We needed that baseball talk. That was good stuff.
Yeah, RJ, man. He's always on top of it.
He is.
Good job. He was very well prepared.
He did an excellent job.
I like that overtime. Yeah, overtime pick.
Yeah, that was slick. That was slick.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was slick. That was slick.
I mean, think about it. It's not that out of this world. I mean, it's a possibility, you know.
especially when you start to take into effect karma and just the way both of those team seasons have been going. It's definitely not that far-fetched of an idea.
Right.
You know, given both of those teams have been having those kind of years where it's just like anything and everything has gone wrong for them, yeah, that could easily actually happen.
So, 2 hours flew by. 2 hours.
It does, don't it? Don't it, man? Especially when you got a good guest going, man. It goes by real fast.
Yeah.
It went by real fast.
Yeah, Larry brought up some good points, too, when he called in. Larry did.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, I think that's why baseball and hockey, you don't see more African-Americans playing hockey. It's because, you know, when you actually look at it, man, I had friends that played hockey. In Wisconsin, a lot of, you know, people play hockey. And I had friends that played hockey. Well, I actually had one friend who played hockey. I'm not going to say friends. I had one friend who played hockey, and hockey is expensive as hell. I mean, we talk about pads and skates and sticks and ice time and, you know, it's expensive, man. It's not a poor person's sport. So, and there are a lot of sports that fall into that category, and that's why you do see most inner-city kids gravitating towards football and basketball.
You know, a sport that could really capitalize if they made more of an effort or kind of strategically thought about tapping into some of the pipelines as far as inner-city athletes is soccer, man. You know, like we talked about baseball, like you need all this equipment, you need to coordinate so many people. Man, you look at third-world countries, they have a ball and a couple of sticks as a goal, and they can make it work.
Right.
You know,
anything that can work in a third world country can work in the inner city.
That's right.
If they can do it over there, it can be done in the inner city. And, you know, honestly, it's just taking somebody to figure that out. And, you know, maybe Major League Soccer, if it wants to spread, that's what it needs to do. Get some billboards up on the south side of Chicago. Get some billboards up in Brooklyn. Get some billboards up in Detroit in the inner city and get kids playing soccer, and you'll see American soccer change. You know, I tell people that all the time. You know, people who are soccer people get offended when you say that, you know, our best athletes in the U.S. don't play soccer, and that's why we don't do well. You know, when you look at the average height of our team compared to Brazil's team, you know, Ronaldinho and the guys that play for Brazil are 6'2", 6'4", 6'5". We got guys 5'10", 6 feet out there running around. You know, just think of if a LeBron James or a Terrell Owens had been groomed to be a soccer player.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? A guy with that amount of quickness, that amount of speed, that amount of coordination, if they had been groomed to play soccer instead of football or basketball, think about how good the U.S. would be in soccer.
And think
about it, man. Or Mike Vick.
Soccer players, I mean, if you had those basic foundations of a soccer player young, those skills translate very well in the other sports that we're more familiar with. I mean, think about a Christian Okoye who played for the Chiefs in the 90s.
Or a King.
Yeah, the Dream, yeah. I mean, both those cats from Nigeria. You know, I mean, that's, you know, both of them attribute their success, their footwork, their agility in terms of their size, to soccer, to their soccer upbringing.
Yeah. You know, maybe that's a conversation we could have at some point.
Yeah.
Throw that out there to folks, because I agree with you. I think that's another sport that could really take off if that's how they're thinking. Who knows if that's what they're thinking, but if they're thinking about, you know, having their game spread beyond suburbia, then, you know, there's a market for it. You know, there's a natural built-in affinity towards it. They just got to go after it.
Yeah, and, you know, and from a cost standpoint, man, soccer is one of the least expensive sports to play in terms of you get a field, you get a goal, and you're ready to go.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I think of some of the soccer complexes that were around our city growing up. I mean, it wasn't nothing but just a few acres of fields, and you could put 4 or 5 soccer fields in that area.
Right. You know, and it's something you can practice solo. You can just go out there, you get a little mark, and you kick at it. You know, you put a little X on the wall, that's your goal, you kick at it. You work on your aim.
Right.
I mean, it's right there.
Yeah. It's going to be a crazy day for baseball tomorrow, man. The Rays and the Sox.
Yeah.
Tied up. They got one game to play, and actually, it looks like I was right. RJ must have not known that the Braves had already lost. The Braves lost, and the Cardinals are up 13-6 in the bottom of the ninth.
Oh.
So, assuming they don't give up 8 runs, they're going to win, and they're going to be tied up on the last day, too, the Cardinals and the Braves.
Yeah, see, this is the kind of stuff that baseball needs to get folks paying attention. You know, this kind of stuff gets people engaged because people like drama. You know, people like to see people playing for something. Because I watch a couple baseball games. I watch if there's something on the line.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, the Tigers and the Twins, Minnesota, they were involved in one of those one-game playoffs. So they ended up the season with the same record, and then they played a one-game playoff to see, you know, winner goes on to the playoffs, loser, they season's over. And actually, there's talk about adding a second wild card for each league, informal talks, and potentially having the two wild cards play in a shorter series, as opposed to a 7-game or a 5-game series, maybe playing a 3-game series or even a 1-game series.
Now, how do you feel about that?
Well, I got to correct my grammar there. It's not no such thing as a one-game series, but right, got to put that on out there. But, you know, I actually kind of like that because it adds a little bit more meaning to winning your division. So, since they changed to the 3-division formats for each league, you know, I believe since they've done that, or at least for like the last 10 years, in the East, in the American League East, the Yankees or the Red Sox have won either their division or the wild card, you know. And to me, the divisional races have very, very little consequence right now, it's especially in that division. Now, some other divisions, it means a little bit more, but for baseball, I mean there's just this culture. I mean, you think about Hall of Fame voters. And this would have been a good topic to get in when we had RJ on, but they just seem to be so fixed in to what baseball was when they grew up.
Right.
You know, and don't want to let it go. They're purists,
mm-hmm.
you know, to a sense. And to me, I think any change in baseball that's going to create more buzz and get more people involved, perhaps get this current generation that's 10, 12, 13, 14 into the sport more, I think that's going to help because guess what? If baseball don't make some changes, man, when our generation, you know, was getting ready to retire, I mean, baseball fans, they've already lost so much of the pie. I mean, it's just going to be a gradual thing, man, where baseball is just going to be insignificant, almost like hockey in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, man. I can see that happening, man, and that's what happened to hockey. That is exactly what happened to hockey. I got to get at Devon real quick, man. I'm looking at these fantasy football scores from last week, man. This dude didn't even score 30 points with his fantasy football team.
What?
This dude, I'm looking at, and he had a full lineup in. Everybody played. His highest score was his defense, and he scored 8 points.
What's the name of this team? Oh, this must be in a different league.
This is in a different league, man. This dude This dude scored 28.27 points. He lost 104-28.
Wow.
I mean, if you look at some of the other scores, I had 124 points last week. The guy I was going against, Larry, he had 114. The guy Devon was going against had 104. There was a guy with 137, 106, 117. And then there were a couple guys in the 80s and then two guys in the 60s. And then Devon at 28 effing points.
Yeah, we got to bring it up next week.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He ain't going to let it down.
Oh, man.
He tried to explain it to him. He over here trying to explain it.
You got to chalk that one up, man. Just,
oh, yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, man, well, I got to get going. I got some work to get done tonight.
Hey, do what you need to do, bro.
Yeah, good show, man.
Very good show. Yeah, that's about three quality shows in a row right there, man. We get into our wheelhouse right now.
There you go.
All right then, brother. Have a good evening.
All right, take care, man.
All right, peace.